Hello and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller here. And today we're going to talk about creating pollinators. Pollinator gardens, I guess we should say, not creating pollinators. Something else will have to do that for us. Melinda Myers with us. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, and columnist, 30 years of horticulture experience and more. And it's always fun to have her come by. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. You've got some gardening questions? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And if you've got a photo, a garden photo, we'd love to see that as well. Melinda Myers, welcome.
Hey, Larry, it's great to be here, and it's good to talk gardening. We finally have some sunny, dry weather, at least in my part of the state. Maybe a little too sunny and dry, but we'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Sandy, on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, posted a really cool photo of a pollinator working her iris, beautiful iris flower. And you think about pollinator gardens. How would you define a pollinator garden, by the way?
You know, one of the things I think is a lot of us are already doing it, whether we intended to or not. You know, gardeners plant beautiful flowers, many of which attract the pollinators. But doing a pollinator garden is taking that idea one step further. So not only providing the nectar, the flowers for the bees and the butterflies and the hummingbirds, but then including things that, like water, because all those pollinators need moisture, food for the caterpillars. A lot of our herbs are excellent for bringing in the feeding the caterpillars and other beneficial insects that keep our bad guys under control. Shelter, you know, those trees and shrubs provide shelter, food for some of the immature places where, like, the leafcutter bee, who's solitary, one of our native bees, cuts little, it almost looks like they took a hole punch to the leaves of your clematis or your rose, and they're solitary and live in the crevices or voids in trees. And so having some of that diversity, leaving some bare spots for the ground bees. I know we don't like them when we dig and want to plant where they're nesting, but if you have space to leave a bare spot, and then for those people like me that like a little more natural look to our garden, meaning shredded leaves as mulch and, you know, leaving your perennial stand for winter, those are great. That's great habitat for a lot of the pollinators. And then, of course, eliminating or at least minimizing your use of chemicals because, you know, they kill the good guys as well as the bad guys. So, and tolerating damage so the birds have something to eat when they come into the garden as well, or the lady beetles have the aphids to eat. So it's all, you know, I find when we work with nature and tolerate a little bit of damage, the surprising thing is nature takes care of most of our issues. But once we step in and start using harsh chemicals and intercede too quickly, that's when we set it off balance, and then it takes a much longer time to get things back in order. So procrastination sometimes pays in the garden.
You know, you mentioned pesticides, and Mark on Facebook says he has a mason bee infestation on his front porch. He says, how do I get them out without insecticides and move them closer to the garden? I've tried plugging the holes in the rafters, but they just make new holes.
And I wonder if those are carpenter bees as opposed to mason bees.
Mason bees are solitary, aren't they?
And so, you know, this sounds like this might be a call. I'm going to just pass it on if you don't have any suggestions. I hate to always say I don't know, but might be one of those for PJ to see if he has any solutions other than using a pesticide, because I know a lot of people have ended up doing that because they're destroying the woodwork or whatever. And if he's tried plugging the holes and that type of thing, smoking them out might be an option, and then quickly plugging the holes to see if you can discourage, maybe covering with some metal, something that would be harder for them to go in. But it sounds more like it might be carpenter bees than mason bees.
I think you're right. I think if, Mark, if you take a photo, if you can get a photo of one of the bees and send that photo to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, you can find that online, UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and shoot that photo to PJ Leash, he should be able to help you out with your question. He's going to, Phil Pelletieri, by the way, is going to be on the show, Jennifer Dargan tells me, on the 21st of June. So that's coming right up as well. But I'd get a photo, and you can send that via, you know, email it to PJ Leash at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, and I think you'll get fairly quick answer from him.
I always do when I've had to send some questions his way. I'm always amazed at how fast, just like Phil, he responds. So, you know, best to go to the expert.
There we go. You can join in with your questions. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Again, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. That was a really pretty photo. And if you've got a nice garden photo, I hope you'll post it up on our Larry Mueller Show Facebook page as well. Well, you know, you talked about a variety of things that many of us have going for us with our garden to attract pollinators. You don't need a lot of space, do you?
No, you know what? Yes, the bigger the space, the better and the easier. But the reality is, even a window box of flowers or a container, I lived in the city for a long time, and I was really the only gardener in my neighborhood for quite a while, and I could get hummingbirds with my Verbena bonariensis, and I'd find things on my containers in my second floor balcony. And actually, Larry, I remember years ago we were talking butterflies, and somebody called and said, you know, I live on the 20th floor and can I get, or on the third floor and can I get butterflies? And someone called and said, I live on the 30th floor and I've had butterflies on my window box. So, you know, always your listeners come through for us. So even a small container can bring them to your backyard and help. You know, and the other thing you might want to do is team up with your neighbor. So, you know, maybe you've both got small yards, but maybe you develop a garden on your lot line so it really increases the space that both of you can use to garden in better space for pollinators. Planting in masses is always the best if you have the room, because then they use less energy going from flower to flower to flower. But you know what? They'll take what they can get. And somebody told me, it was funny, they live in a neighborhood where they started a pollinator garden, and it was catching on. And so everyone in that neighborhood decided to make their community suitable for pollinators. So everybody jumped on board. So even though it wasn't one huge yard, it was a large area that could invite the pollinators and provide plenty of food, so they use less energy going from one place to the next to gather nectar or pollen.
That's a really great
idea. Isn't that a great idea?
I love that. Well, when you think about kind of favorite plants to include in the garden, you mentioned sort of in general some flowers, but what are some favorites of yours for pollinators?
You know, I'm a hummingbird fanatic, and I didn't start feeding them from feeders until the last few years, just being busy and wanting to make sure I could keep them clean and do all of that. But salvia, black and blue salvia, which is a big annual salvia with deep blue flowers in the receptacle, the part that holds the flowers, black. And I don't even have mine in the ground yet. They're still in pots, and the hummingbirds were out visiting them already. So salvias are great for butterflies and hummingbirds. And then when they set seed, the finches will eat them. So you kind of got a 3-4 out of that. I love dill and fennel, even though it recedes. And I use it for cooking a little, but I really plant it for the swallowtail caterpillars, that and parsley. And they love it. And so you'll get the caterpillars, which means the butterflies are coming to lay their eggs on that. So you'll get all stages, which is pretty exciting, I think, even for older gardeners, not just for kids.
Oh, absolutely.
And butterfly weed is the 2017 perennial plant of the year. And it's got those beautiful orange flowers summer into fall. Milkweed, of course, is important for our monarch butterflies because that's their food source. So the butterfly weed is a type of milkweed, a little more garden acceptable, a little bit less aggressive than the common milkweed, though I'm a fan of common milkweed, and everyone knows when they come to my yard, you'll find it growing wherever it seeds. fragrance. I know, it's funny. We had a friend of my daughter's was over years ago, and she goes, you know, you've got those are weeds. She was pointing to the milkweed, feeling very embarrassed. And I said, well, some people think they are, but I leave them for the caterpillars, the monarchs, and the monarch adults. And we found some, and she yells to her husband, hey, Noel, quit pulling it. It's good stuff.
I love that story. You have a presentation. Before I forget about it, you have a presentation on this subject next week, isn't it?
You bet, and thank you. I hope all the folks in the Wausau area will come and join me at Monk Gardens, a relatively new botanic garden in that area, so I'm so excited to be there and help support Sue at HSU, in case somebody looks it up and can't find Sue. It's HSU Growing Supplies is sponsoring some refreshments and the event and very active with the botanic garden in that area. So I'm hoping it people will join me. It's free. It's at 6 o'clock on Thursday the 15th at Monk Gardens. Visit their Facebook page and website. All the details are there. But I'm talking pollinators, so I'm bringing a few of my containers along, and probably we'll have a black and blue salvia that I'll pull out of the car. And we'll have last time we had a wonderful evening in their kitchen garden area and just chatted and visited. And it's just a good break from all that weeding. You can come and think about new plants to add to your garden and things to do to bring in the pollinators.
So that's June 15th, and what's the time again and where again?
6 p.m. at Monk Gardens.
All right, there we go. Well, we'll mention it again as we go along.
Thank
here.
You.
Joya in Fitchburg has a question. Let's go to her. Hi, Joya.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for Melinda.
Yes,
okay. I am having, these peonies are about 34 years old, but I divided them once about 10 years ago. This year, last year, they had some disease on the leaves, so I cut them in September almost to the bottom of the plant. This year, the plant grew. The buds are there, but they're not flowering.
Okay, a couple things. Peonies are susceptible to Phytophthora and Botrytis blight, and that's very common when we have wet weather, and some parts of the state had a lot of moisture last year,
yep.
Or if the plants are under stress. So you did the right thing, pruning them back in the fall, getting rid of those diseased leaves, great way. I've seen plants infected for several years with the right weather conditions, you've got the disease, and then it eventually clears up as the weather improves. So you did the right thing. In terms of the buds not opening, there are a couple things that can happen. There's the botrytis blight with a lot of moisture, and boy, have we had it this spring.
Yeah.
You'll often see botrytis blight on roses, especially whites and pinks, and some of them peonies. And the buds form, but they turn brown and fail to open. And that can be from the botrytis blight. And there's nothing you can do but, clip those off and get them out of the garden so they don't spread the disease to the rest of the plant. Sometimes stress, we've had crazy weather this year, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold, hot. And some plants have thrived and done well, and others that you would expect to do okay have suffered a little bit. One of my peonies bloomed and was done in 3 days. My Bartzell is just looking gorgeous. My other one didn't last too long. So a lot of it could be temperature and moisture. It's been dry for the last 5 or 6 days, and with sandy soil, things are pretty dry out there. I was out weeding this morning. And so watching the moisture, checking to see if the buds are brown, clip those off if they are to get them out of the garden, and that's really the best thing you can do. Peonies, as you know, can stay in the same location for decades. Hundred-year-old plants that have never been divided and are doing great as long as the growing conditions are right. But the weather, nothing you did wrong. You did everything right, and it's just a matter of the weather cooperating a little bit better.
Joya, thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Melinda Myers about your garden, and we're talking a little about pollinators, but taking other gardening questions as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Jennifer Dargan, our on-air producer for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Visiting today with Melinda Myers, she has written, how many books do you have now, Melinda? 20 at least?
At least, yeah. I kind of, yeah. that sounds good. We'll stop there.
But I love your website as well.
Well, thank you. And we're we try to provide lots of information, audio and video tips, frequently asked questions, things that try to help people along their way, because our goal is to help you have fun and be successful in your garden. And if you're not having fun, then I'm not doing my job. So we need to make sure we all have a little frustration, but if it's more fun than frustrating, then we're on the right track.
MelindaMyers.com, if I'm not mistaken.
You got it.
I think we have a link on our Facebook page as well. Let's take another call, this one from Jeff in Greendale. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. I just had a suggestion for a great pollinator I don't think was mentioned yet today. For years, I have had salvia and Russian sage in my garden, and the bees love that. But about 2 or 3 years ago, I planted, I think it's called Anise hyssop.
Oh, yes.
The bees pretty much have abandoned the sage and salvia, and whenever they can, they swarm on the hyssop till they can't anymore, and then they go back to the sage and the salvia, which is really interesting. And plus, it's got a great licorice smell to it, too. So just a suggestion for
another plant.
It's very hardy, and
and it reads, thank you so much. That's a great suggestion, Jeff. Good fragrance. It kind of has the look of salvia, but I find it a lot easier to grow, combines nicely with others. It does seed around a bit, but then you have plenty of plants for those pollinators. The other one I wanted to mention, you just inspired me to mention Calmentha, which is an underutilized plant. It's white, it's kind of airy. It reminds me of baby's breath, but it's heat, drought tolerant, grows in our clay soil, very tough plant, about 24 inches tall, and right 20 inches tall and wide. And we have it at our state fair gardens at We Energy Energy Park. And when you walk by, it's like, because the bees are all over that plant. So thank you, Jeff. You inspired me to mention a few others. I know there are others that have just wonderful ideas, and there's so many plants for the pollinators. So thank you. You're right. The Anise hyssop is a great one to include.
And somebody just said, well, wait a minute. What was it that Melinda said? Which plant was that Melinda said?
The Calmentha, which is C-A-L-I-M-I-N-T-H, and you want to get Calmentha nepeta nepeta, and I'm not stuttering. It's a subspecies that tends not to seed around as readily, unless you want seedlings, but it can get a little seedy, but it's a clumper. You know, when you hear mint, you go, oh, no, but it's a clumper, so it doesn't take over. But check out Calmentha.
Okay. All right.
And it's a wonderful plant, underutilized, becoming a little more available, so it shouldn't be as hard to find anymore.
Got an open line or two for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Judy in Madison next. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry and Melinda.
Hi, Judy.
I have a tomato question. Is that okay?
Sure.
You bet.
Okay, great. Over the years, I keep hearing some of the complaints about lack of calcium for tomatoes, and I seem to get those problems that they talk about. I'm wondering if I can go to the drugstore, buy a bottle of calcium carbonate, crush the tablets up, and put it in the soil around the tomato plants.
You know, one of the things, I have great news for you. You don't need to do that. We have plenty of calcium in our soils here in Wisconsin, and I know blossom end rot, they talk about it being a calcium deficiency. But what we see, unless you have your soil test and find out otherwise, but what we see is it's a moisture imbalance. So we have wet, then dry, then wet, then dry, and so the plants can't pull up the moisture and the nutrients, including the calcium, that it needs. So really, if you plant and stake or tower your tomatoes at the same time, mulch them to hold the moisture and keep it consistently moist, avoid shallow cultivation, deep cultivation that damages those shallow roots, you really should see fewer problems with blossom end rot. If you do all those things, the calcium, you know, it's in some parts of the country, it's necessary. But here for us, it's about the moisture imbalance. So keeping that soil water thoroughly, when the top few inches start to dry, water thoroughly to encourage good deep roots that are more drought resistant. And you may find more problems in containers, right, because they dry out so quickly. So mulching your containers, making sure you water your containers once, and in really hot weather, if they're small, maybe twice a day. So the calcium, really adding calcium isn't necessary for us because we have plenty in our soil. So just kind of watch that watering and that moisture, and that should really help with blossom end rot.
Yeah. I never have any problems with the straw bales with when I have my tomatoes and straw bales. The blossom end rot just doesn't exist.
Right. And I don't. And you're keeping them well watered.
Yeah.
You've got that rich compost. I don't have problems, and I have sandy soil, but I mulch. And when I water thoroughly. So, yeah, good point. And so organic matter in your soils improves drainage in clay, and it also helps hold moisture in sandy conditions. And that straw bale, that's basically what you're gardening in, is that great compost you've created. So, good point.
I have my straw bales look like they're a pincushion with mushrooms plants right now. They're really, I thought, I'm really happy with these straw bales because they're producing a lot of mushrooms, which tells me that we're doing something right with the straw bales. So.
Well, that's good. I think you need to write the supplement to Joel's book, because every time somebody asks me about straw bale gardening, but yep, I've done it, I, you know, blah, blah. But boy, Larry Mueller is the guy.
Well, Judy, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Tab in Mazamani has something for us. So let's go there. Tab, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I was just going to add about the question with the tomatoes. When I plant my tomatoes, I give them I plant them like 10 inches deep, and I give them a fistful of bone meal in the bottom. And then once they set fruit, before they start to turn color, I give them a big spoonful of bone meal and Epsom salt. And that kind of takes care of the cracking and the bottom end rot.
But, Tab, I bet you make sure that those tomato plants get an inch of water a week, too.
Oh, I have them all, like your guest said, they're all mulched, and I have straw in between them, and I never do overhead watering. Always
you
at
know.
The bottom.
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. And soaker hoses are so much more available these days in terms of making it easier for us, too. One concern about bone meal, you just want to be careful. It often attracts rodents. So if you have problems with critters that like to munch on things, that's why a lot of people planting bulbs have given up on the bone meal, because they found it brought the rodents to the bulbs. So not only did they enjoy the bone meal, but also the bulbs. But thank you for sharing it, Tab. But one of the things I love about your listeners, Larry, they always have good, they always have ideas they like to pass along to others.
Thanks again, Tab. Let's go to Tom in Sussex next. Hi. Thanks a lot, Tom, for calling.
Thank you. I got a question about a spring pollinator, my cherry tree. This spring, it bloomed beautifully, and then most of the leaves on the lower part of the tree never came out. So it's not very happy. So I was wondering, could that be frost damage, or could it possibly have some kind of disease?
It's possible for both, but honestly, I saw a lot of frost damage this year where trees started to leaf out. The frost hit those buds as they're starting to expand, are very sensitive to frost. You know, those scales really protect them from the cold weather, but as they break open, I saw a lot of frost damage because of our crazy weather. The good news is healthy trees usually send out new buds, but it takes a while, and will send out new growth. Now, there are some diseases that will hit cherries. Gamosis, which is a bacteria that blocks the flow of the xylem and the phloem, you usually see some oozing. You'll also can see some problems with borers, but you'd see some holes and then some sap oozing out as well. So if it looked pretty healthy going into winter, if it put out a good floral display, and then if it seems like it coincided with that cold snap maybe hitting those leaves, the only thing you can do at this point is wait and see. If it's dead, it's dead, and it might be hard for Brian to culture out, you know, which thing killed it, but that's always a possibility to send a sample to the plant disease diagnostic clinic. But if those branches are still pliable, I would wait. I'm seeing things just leafing out, just starting some trees that look like they're just recovering. It's hard when they've already put out a lot of growth. It gets damaged. It takes a while for them to kind of, you know, reset and start putting out new leaves. So you know, I think it's a wait and see. And if you do to see some distortion on the leaves or dead branches or cankers, then you know it's a sign of disease.
Yeah. I was thinking back to a visit to Watertown and a couple of weeks back, and I could tell you every ash tree in the neighborhood, because there wasn't a single one of them that were leafed out.
Yeah. Yeah.
They leave at different times sometimes. And
you know, and that's a good point. Trees, you know, we kind of forget that things leaf out at different time frames, and then that cold snaps that we had, depending on where they were. Good point, Larry. So, yeah. And so patience is one of those things that's really a hard thing for all of us, especially gardeners.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Tom, for calling. You know, Pat on Facebook wonders, we've been talking a little bit about moisture. Do you have a recommendation for an accurate moisture tester for both indoor and outdoor plants?
You know, I used to do interior plantscaping when I was in college, and we had moisture meters. Now, granted, that was 37 years ago, and things have improved, but I ended up finding my finger was my best moisture meter. And, you know, you can feel the soil, and after a while, you actually do get used to kind of looking at the plants. Like the green is kind of a more of a gray green, or you lift up the pot, and, you know, it's lightweight. You know, and then I think as you get used to those signs above ground, you don't have to stick your finger in the soil as often. But I find that really touching the soil and feeling the moisture, you know, when you're trying to water outside, is it crumbly and moist? And, you know, digging down not just at the surface, if it's, especially if it's not mulched, but down a few inches to see what's going on in the root zone. I know it's putzy. I really personally have not found a moisture meter that I felt did as good a job as my finger did.
Yeah, I've got one that I don't trust.
Okay. And we're not naming names, but
no. I've experimented between my finger and the moisture meter, and my finger works better.
You know, that's kind of what I found, too.
Oh, boy. Michelle in Prairie du Sac, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. I actually have two questions, and they're both about trees. One is I planted two Honeycrisp trees, or apple trees, and I didn't see any blooms on either one of them. I do have a Yellow Delicious and two Haroldsons, and my Haroldsons were, you know, had a lot of blossoms on it. Do I need a different kind of tree other than, you know, the two Honeycrisp to make that actually pollinate? And then
okay.
my second question is about a maple tree, but...
Okay. If you don't mind, I'll answer the apple, and then I don't have to remember both.
Yeah, that's good plan.
Okay. So the Honeycrisp, you don't need to flower. They'll flower by themselves. Where you need additional varieties and things for anything that needs cross-pollination is once they bloom, you need something where the pollen can be accepted. So flowering is independent of needing a pollinator, if that makes sense. So your Honeycrisp failed to bloom. Now, you said you just planted them. How old are those?
One is actually about 4 years old, and then the other one's a year old.
Well, I'm not surprised the one-year-old did not bloom. They don't always flower the first couple of years. Mainly, they're putting their energy and putting roots down. The old recommendations were, if they did flower, to pick off the flowers. But I was listening to Larry's show when you had the fruit specialist on, and learned that that's not the case anymore. So I always learn something new when I listen to you, Larry. So not surprised you didn't see blooms. Usually with standard type fruit trees, it can be 5 or more years before we start getting flowers and fruit. And then on compact varieties, it's several years. You know, so I'm not surprised you didn't get flowers. Again, timing, bloom time. It might have been the ones that did form flowers, but you didn't see them. The flower buds may have been damaged by the frost, and they bloom at different times than your others, and that could be part of the problem. We want to be careful not to over-fertilize, especially if you're growing in clay soil. Our soils tend to have a lot of nutrients with the clay soil, and adding too much fertilizer can stimulate leaf and stem growth at the expense of blooms.
I have very sandy soil.
Okay, me too. That's probably not the issue. Weather might be the issue, and age might be the issue. Did it flower for you last year, the older Honeycrisp?
No, it has never done it.
So yeah. That's why I thought, I'm going to buy another Honeycrisp. Maybe it needs two.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of age. And then are you training them? You obviously know about training and opening them up. So for good light penetration, for fruiting and flowering to occur, if you haven't established a pruning program, you might want to look into that so that you can start pruning, developing that major scaffolding, removing crossing, rubbing branches so you get better light penetration into the tree, and that will encourage flowering, and that also helps increase fruit production.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my second question is about a maple tree, and it's one we've had for 23 years in our yard, or, you know, maybe 20 for sure. And it's a beautiful tree, but right now it seems to be, you look at the base of the tree, and then there's a bunch of leaves at the bottom. They're green, obviously, not color, and we cannot find a bug maybe cutting it off, or what should I be looking for?
Probably squirrels.
It could
be squirrels.
Oh.
Okay.
And the other thing it could be is twig girdlers. And they're caterpillars that feed on, you know, usually like 6 inches, kind of like squirrels do, from the tip, and they'll chew around the stem, but usually after a good wind comes through and knocks them off. And so you'll find a bunch of branches. So either squirrels or these twig girdlers. And the problem with twig girdlers is they're so random. Well, it's not a problem. There's no point in treating them because,
no.
You know, I guess that's a good thing, right? You can't control them anyway, so relax. And if your tree's good and healthy, it can tolerate that damage. Trees usually produce more, you know, they have a lot of volume of leaves. So usually if the tree's healthy, this does very minimal, you know, it's minimal to that. So rake them up, compost them, whatever. If they're squirrels...
same advice.
Yeah,
you can't do anything about it.
Good
point. Why am I dreaming not dying? That's all I really do.
Okay.
Thanks for your help.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Jeff from Grand Marsh, he called, but there was a bad connection, so he couldn't stay on. But he'd like to know the difference between topsoil and clay. He's...
You know, that's a great, I'm sorry to laugh, Jeff, because I have a great story to tell. When I worked for the city of Milwaukee, the city does a great job. They put together really good specs for topsoil. And so we were sitting in the person that year who got the bid none of us had ever heard of. And we'd all had quite a bit of experience in the area. So we sent our technician out to take samples. And he calls me and he goes, well, where do I take the sample? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, this layer looks very different than this layer that looks very different than this layer. So here's the deal with topsoil. You know, a farmer sells this field, and they go and they scrape the top couple inches of soil off, and there's topsoil. Well, guess what? Then there's 2 inches deeper, there's topsoil. Now, a quality topsoil company will usually provide quality soil, add in some organic material, usually sell it as a blended garden mix. So I don't want to slam all topsoil providers, but there's a lot of variability out there, and so there aren't a lot of regulations. So sometimes you end up with clay soil, and sometimes you end up with a good blend. And so I remember when Frank Rossi was here working in the turf department, he was saying a lot of people have switched over to compost. Again, you can find a lot of variability, but using compost to amend what they have rather than bringing something in that they're not sure what they're getting. The other concern are the weed seeds. You know, if that field has laid fallow for a year before whatever happens and they harvest the topsoil, that can be an issue, too, that you're bringing weeds in as well. So the thing I always recommend is if you're considering buying topsoil is, you know, talk to friends who have purchased some and been happy. Find out where they're buying it. Talk to the provider about, you know, is it a blend? What's the mix? You know, they should be able to answer those questions. Extension, the soil test lab will do testing. The problem is if you test it and then the next load may be somewhat different. So that's kind of, it can be clay, and it can be a nice blend of organic matter depending on where they're harvesting it.
So can you find anything out on the label?
And, well, usually if you're buying it, that's a good point. Whatever it says on the label has to be true, but there aren't any real regulations. So, you know, looking at the label, seeing if it talks about a blend, if they call it a loam, and how much percent of organic matter it's in there. You know, 5% is always ideal in ground soil. I was thinking on buying in bulk, but you're right. A lot of times we go and buy the bag stuff. I've bought bag stuff that was almost like sand, and I've bought bag stuff that was pretty heavy clay, and, you know, end up doing a lot of amending that way. So, yeah, good question. Check the label, but unfortunately, there's not a lot of regulations on that in potting mixes, other than if they call themselves organic. That's pretty highly regulated.
And I've got it just as an aside. I hadn't heard Frank Rossi's name in a long time. Frank used to come on the show and talk about lawn care and so forth. He always called himself the Lawn Ranger.
Yeah. And I think he's out in Cornell now.
I think he's still in Cornell.
So quite a character.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, man. Carol in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Hi, Carol.
What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a Baptisia in my border garden, and it doesn't bloom. I think this is the second year, maybe the third year, and it comes up beautifully. The greens are just lovely, but no blooms. And I notice, you know, different gardens around town, the Baptisia is in bloom. So I'm just wondering what might be wrong.
Is it growing in full sun, part sunshade?
It's in full sun.
What other plants do you have other plants in the garden that are blooming or not blooming?
Yep. I've got to the one side, the west of it, I've got Nepeta. And to the east of it, I've got some poppies blooming. I think right now that's all I have going.
Okay. So it sounds like you've got good soil for flowering, not too much fertilizer. Baptisias are in the legume family, so they like it pretty light because they fix their own nitrogen and add it to the soil. So that's probably not the problem. You've got the right amount of sunlight. By year three, you should start, you know, that old saying, the first year they sleep, second year they creep, third year they leap. So you should be starting to see. So you think it's your second or third year for this plant?
I do, yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't give up on it yet. I just watch the fertilization just because they really are very light feeders, and I'd give it one more year and then threaten death if that works. They're kind of tough plants to transplant. They do put down a pretty deep root system, so I'm wondering if they're just spending a lot more energy getting rooted in rather than putting that energy into flowering. So I wouldn't...
I'd wait another year anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure.
Okay.
All right.
We'll give it a reprieve.
All right.
Okay, yep, right. Tell it, though. It's got one more year.
There we go. Oh, man. Melinda Myers, gardening expert, our guest here on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Well, if you love WPR and the Green Bay Packers, then you're not going to want to miss a special event I'm hosting at Lambeau Field on June 22nd in Green Bay. We'll spend the evening exploring Packers history with team president Mark Murphy and historian Cliff Crystal. Then we're going to have a tailgate-style reception. So I hope you can join us. It's a family-friendly centennial event in Green Bay, and it's this month. You can get tickets on our Centennial website, so just go to WPR.org/100. You know what? WPR and the Packers? I don't think it gets much more Wisconsin than that. Do you, Melinda?
I don't, and both of you together, hey.
It's a good time. Should be a lot of fun. In the meantime, if you have a question or a comment or maybe an experience, gardening experience to share, I hope you'll join in as we visit with Melinda Myers. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we can get you on pretty quickly. So give a call or shoot a note, and we'll help you out here if we can. And I am now trying to find my mouse pointer. Oh, here we go. Chris, sometimes I lose it on the screen. Chris on Facebook says, I inherited two mature trees that were encircled probably 40 years ago with planters around their bases. So the dirt was mounded up. Can I just cut those things off? The trees have grown all the way out to the edges. of the pile of dirt, I guess, that was piled up around those trees. I'm surprised the trees didn't die, to be perfectly honest.
I'm with you. I was thinking the same thing, and I'm like, well, they've made it this far, so I guess that's a good thing. Yeah, what you may want to do is, so what happens when trees are buried, sometimes it kills them, and that's why both Larry and I are a little surprised. As little as an inch of soil over the majority of the roots can kill trees, and especially when it's up against the trunk, it can cause rot. Sometimes we'll see trees that look perfectly healthy to us blow over in a storm, and when you look at the trunk, it's straight to where it was buried, then it's rotten, and then the root system. You may want an arborist to come and just make sure it's nice and sound before you start pulling that away, because if you pull that planter away, then maybe you want to gradually, you know, if the roots are up in the surface, they've already rooted and adjusted, and then just gradually taper that away from that planter or put some mulch in there. I'm just trying to picture how you would make that transition.
Yeah. It's pretty hard. Some of those trees, I mean, you know, like maples we were talking about earlier, those roots are right up at the surface, and you don't want to be damaging those roots, I don't think.
Right. So if you're just, if you can peel the planter away, then you're going to have those roots right there. So, and then how high was it to kind of gradually taper it into the surrounding bed? And what may have happened is the tree may have probably gone under the planter, sent out roots at the level, current level of soil beyond that. So then you'd be burying those, causing other issues.
Yeah.
And so she's probably like, oh, this is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. So sorry about that. But that's where certified, the Wisconsin Arborist Association, if you go to their website, just Wisconsin Arborist Association or Trees Are Good, has a list of certified arborists, and you can go by the area where you live. And these are folks that have taken a test, a voluntary test, showing a certain level of knowledge, and then, and I'm a certified arborist and required to keep up on our education, and so we keep up to date and current. But that's a good starting point to find a quality professional to come out and look at your tree. But then they can take a look at it. They can evaluate the soundness of the trunk. They can look at that root system. They can see, you know, they've got equipment, too, if they decide they need to, you know, excavate the roots with an air spade to see what's happening, make sure there's no girdling roots. So before you invest in changing the look of those trees, you may decide that it's better off to either leave them as is, or if there is an issue, they can help you find that.
Let's turn to Terry in Milwaukee next. Terry, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Mel. This is Terry in Milwaukee. How you doing?
Oh, hey, I'm doing great. Good to hear from you.
Good. Hey, thanks. Hey, you know, I'm pretty good on flowers. I am not quite so good on vegetables. I belong to a little community garden in my neighborhood. We've got about 40-ish like 4x8 beds, raised beds. We've got a good water source. Soil is pretty good. We fertilize with Milorganite. It's a good sunny area. We had a leftover pile of dirt, so we planted a community pumpkin patch. And other people have put in, you know, some vine crops in their beds. We get good growth. We get lots of flowers, very few fruits. And I'm thinking maybe this is a pollination problem. What could we stick in the middle of our pumpkin patch?
You know, you're right. Pumpkins need bees for pollination. Borage, B-O-R-A-G-E, with that kind
borage.
Of, I do too. Blue flowers, it does reseed, so that's a perfect one for pumpkins. They can seed each, you know, take each other on. But the bees love that, and that would be a nice one to put nearby. You know, if you've got kids involved, give them each a little kid's paintbrush to go do pollination. They might like to play the part of the bees.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, pollination can be an issue. So getting some of those flowers, any flower would be great, but I find borage is another one of those plants that's, you know, they just are buzzing when you walk by. And once you put it, you'll probably keep having those seedlings, so you can always put them back around your pumpkin patch every year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's great. Thank you so much for your help, Mel.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Terry. Good to chat with you.
Thanks for calling. And Kay in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I have a question about the tall, I think it's called tall bellflower, that is taking over the east side of Milwaukee. I don't think it was around 5 or 6 years ago, and now I'm seeing it in everyone's gardens, and it seems impossible to dig out. And I don't like using pesticides. I was wondering what, if anything, you recommend to get rid of that. And I'm going to take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Kate. Well, the good news for you is you've only seen it for 6 years. I remember finding it on garden tours on the east side like 20 years ago. Some people know it not only as tall bellflower, but running bellflower, and it is very aggressive, as you mentioned. It spreads by rhizomes, and so like so many rhizomaceous plants, any little piece that's left behind can start a new plant. So digging, you know, is one way to try to get ahead, and then make sure that you take every piece of that rhizome out with you. I had a gentleman I was speaking at, I was in Ohio, and he had had equisetum, and this will relate, Kay, just hang in there with me. And if you know horsetail, it is an awful one. He goes, yeah, he goes, last year I told you I had a problem with equisetum, and I told you I tilled it, and you went, ooh, bad move. And he goes, it was, because I had more. What he ended up doing is taking a pitchfork and reaching in and digging up and lifting the rhizomes out, and said he didn't eliminate it, but he got rid of a lot. And I'm wondering if that might be another method for any of those rhizomaceous plants. If you can get under and lift up, and you might be more successful getting those rhizomes as well as the plant out. Regularly cutting them back, as long as you keep after them so you starve the plant to death. But, you know, because they have little runners, you've got to get every sprout that comes up. So continual cutting, continual digging, and that's really the only option if you don't want to use pesticides. You could try edging the bed, making sure they're all contained, covering it with either clear plastic to cook it out, but, you know, you need to make sure you're not cooking out the good guys, or black plastic to suffocate it, and that's another option as well. But then you're taking your garden out of service. The other caution I would give is a lot of times people will dig up the good guys, kill out the weeds, and then replant the good guys back in. I always recommend potting up any good plants you want to save, and the reason being is let them grow, because if any piece of that rhizome is in with that good guy, you want it to sprout, and you want to know before you put the good guy in this bed, you finally rid of your weed problem.
There we go.
Right? Yeah. Wow. So, Kay, I wish I had a good answer. You're right. It's gotten worse, and I think you're just seeing more of it because people haven't been able to take it under control. And somebody once gave me great advice, and they said, if you go to a yard sale and you see 100 plants for a quarter, turn around and walk away.
Yeah.
Because if you buy them, you will have 100 plants for a quarter.
Yeah.
And you're going to need to get rid of them. And so I think sometimes not only do we get those aggressive plants, but sometimes we get some unwanted companions coming along with it. So just always be careful when you're buying, because sometimes you get some weedy and aggressive plants that you may not have intended. So thank you, Kay. I'm sure a lot of people will join your battle with that running or tall bellflower.
Mm. Larry in Appleton, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, the lady that was saying about the apple tree that wasn't blooming.
Yeah.
I was told by a nursery that if you take a baseball bat and you hit the trunk, why it works, I don't know, but it's worked for me and my brother. So I figured I'd just pass that around.
Well, thank you. I'm always hesitant to give that because depending on how frustrated and angry you are, you could damage and kill the tree. So you and your brother must have the right touch, Larry. The idea is it damages some of the phloem, and the idea supposedly is it puts the carbon and nitrogen in better balance, and so that encourages bloom. Now, would your tree still flower without hitting with a bat? You know, who knows? But just before you break out the bat, just be careful, because I'd hate for you to kill your tree. Obviously, Larry and his brother have the right touch, but, you know, too much of a good thing can be painful.
Yes.
It flowered for a whole bunch of years, and then we did that, and it flowered. So.
Oh, great.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Larry.
Judy in Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Hi. First, I wanted to put in a little plug for our Master Gardener plant sale in Eau Claire, Phoenix Park, on Sunday, 10 to 2. But I did want to ask a question. I'm going to be digging up lupins and ferns,
yep.
And I was wondering if those were considered native.
Virginia bluebells?
Lupins and ferns?
Oh, I thought you said bluebells. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know where I heard that. Lupinus perennis is our native lupine, and that's native. There are cultivated varieties of lupines. Depends on the variety of fern that you're digging up, whether it's native or not. So
you need an identification, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not real sure. Any tips on digging those kind of plants up?
Well, with ferns, I find can be sometimes challenging. So are you digging these for your plant sale?
Yes.
Okay. So I would suggest with anything with lupine, with ferns especially, some can be very, if they're ostrich ferns especially, I find that with those big long fronds that flop over, I find those almost look dead and then they make a nice comeback.
Out of time here. So.
Okay, and then so go quickly, and then just as younger, better, and make sure you give them good post-transplant care. And with lupines, little seedlings, you should have no problem with. The bigger plants might be a little more challenging. So seedlings and smaller, better, easier option.
Melinda Myers, our guest for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and really happy to have Melinda Myers back with us. Nationally known gardening expert, TV radio host, author, columnist, over 30 years of horticulture experience, and the author of over 20 gardening books. So she knows a whole lot, and if you have a gardening question, I hope you'll join us. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you have photos for our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, we'd love to have those gardening photos as well. And you can post a question there as well. And we do have some great photos on Facebook. Jim posted some nice bush peonies. Kathy posted a great shot of a swallowtail butterfly. Lisa on Facebook says, I have milkweed plants that don't blossom, they just have leaves. Are the flowers necessary, and is there a way that I can encourage them to flower?
So for milkweeds, being perennial, usually it's the second year they bloom for you, though milkweeds are pretty prolific, especially the common milkweed. Again, watch the fertilization. They're really good at growing in abandoned fields and waste places. I tend to do very little fertilizing. I have really good healthy soil, and I like to use a low-nitrogen slow-release, Milorganite, because it doesn't interfere with bloom, so always watch your fertilization. The caterpillars feed on the milkweed, so the flowers feed the adults. The caterpillars need the leaves, so you are still helping the cause. And so I just watch your fertilization, good sunny conditions. And I kind of find I grow a lot of butterfly weed, and I always laugh because I plant it where I think it will look good, and it grows where it chooses.
Yeah.
So, and it's late to emerge. So if you're growing butterfly weed, you always have to be careful when you go out and do your spring cleanup that you don't dig it up as well. I'd give it time. You know, it's still early. My butterfly weed is just a few of them are just getting to the right size to be starting to put some blooms on, so it's still pretty early. We see a lot of things in the garden centers blooming because they're in pots, and they've been started earlier. So patience. This is one that, wait a while. It's going to take a while for those common milkweeds to get into flower. So, you know, just watch your fertilization. Good sun. Move them to better locations if they pop up in the shade, but if you're getting them for free because the seeds are blowing in, you'll probably find some that get established where they'll find the right growing conditions and start blooming for
you.
Yeah.
You know, I usually wind up spending a fair amount of money at the garden centers just because I want some of those flowers blooming right now.
And that's okay, because I do the same thing, Larry. In fact, I have a bunch that need to get in the ground. So it's kind of fun to do. You know, you can save money by starting things from seed. And here's what I think. You start some things from seed if you need to save money. And then you do what Larry and I are doing and buy some things that are in bloom so you get that quick fix. And then the other seeded things, extend your planting budget so you can buy those few special plants that you really want, but still fill up some of those spaces in the garden. I was putting in a lot of, I love Blue Horizon Ageratum that hummingbirds and butterflies like. It's a 20-inch tall or more Ageratum, and you're used to seeing the short ones.
It's yeah.
It blends nicely with perennials. And so I was kind of in my garden, got things weeded in one of the beds, and I'm like, oh, I'll fill in some of those holes with this. And it just, it looks like I really have a spectacular garden, even when things die.
Well, let's go to Marcia at Sturgeon Bay next. Marcia, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have this invasive plant that is spreading in my flower beds. It looks like snow on the mountain, but it's totally green, and it spreads like wildfire, and it's overtaking everything. I've tried pulling it, but it has runners. Yeah, the roots just run, and it pops up someplace else. I've tried digging it out, but it's been an impossible task to get rid of it. What can I do?
It is. So snow on the mountain, a lot of people call snow on the mountain Agapodium, which is also known as bishop's weed or gout mm-hmm. weed. And this is just the green variety. And so okay. the variegated one is a cultivar of the green one, and sometimes it will mutate the variegated one back to the green one. The bad news is the green one is even more aggressive than the variegated one. And if you've tried Roundup, and you know that it, one shot does not kill it.
Right.
This is another one where mowing it and keeping after it, but you're right, then one pops up over here and there. If it's contained somewhat in a bed or a garden, mm-hmm. edging the garden to try to slow it from running out, creeping out into other areas, or if you could isolate it that way. I haven't tried it, and I try to use minimal chemicals, but I do admit
right.
I'm using Roundup because I have a lot of quack grass. I dig and dig and dig. But they have a new one. I haven't tried it yet that is, it almost looks like a roll-on deodorant that you can wipe on. You could mix up and paint it on with a sponge brush.
Okay.
Spot treat. And that's a couple of things. That way you're protecting your good plants. I'll sometimes put a milk jug over the weed and spray, let it drip dry, move it to the next weed. Or I'll cover my good plant if I have more quack grass than good plant and paint it on so I'm protecting the good plants and minimizing the use of chemical. Instead of spraying, the whole area, I try to really use minimal product. The good part is it's absorbed through the leaves and goes to the roots. The bad part is gout weed. You're going to need several applications and persistence, as you know already. I heard that it was called bishop's weed because it was so aggressive it was enough to make a bishop curse. I don't know if that's true, but I bet you'd think right now, like I do, trying to battle it, that must be the case.
I believe that's true. And I noticed in my front yard now, my neighbor has some growing under their hedges, and now it's creeping into my bed of hostas. So,
and I know it's always a hard, depending on your relationship with your neighbor, ganging up on it, if you can convince them, they may not even notice it or realize it,
mm-hmm.
that that's an issue, and maybe getting them to work with you. When I lived in the city, I was getting garlic mustard all of a sudden, and I was like, oh, this is more than usual. And I found under my neighbor's spruce tree, I pulled out 5 bags of garlic mustard. And I hadn't seen it, and she'd never seen it. And so that was the source, one of the major sources in my yard. And so, yeah, it's always a tough conversation depending on your neighbor, but that might – you know, the last thing you want to do is kill it in your garden, and then it's coming in from next door.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
have that conversation.
Yes. And then, you know, some people cover it up, and I've had people that said they covered their area for 2 years and still hadn't killed the stuff. But edging is critical so that you're not getting outside plants feeding the inside plants and edging to keep it and slow it from spreading. So I wish I had a good answer for you, but unfortunately it's just persistence. And if you use any broadleaf weed killers, then there's a long wait period before you can replant. So just keep that in mind. Always check the label, whether it's an organic or synthetic product, no matter what you're spraying, because there's good information on there to tell you how to be safe, but also the consequences and time to replanting or harvest or whatever you're using that chemical for.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Marcia, for calling. Jim on Facebook says, we're frequently out of town for 3 to 7 days at a time, and so our straw bale garden requires constant moisture monitoring. I could agree with that. We have water to the garden, so there's, you know, that available. Is there a moisture monitoring automatic water system we could use?
Yeah, you know, what I would just check, if you, and I would test it when you're home, yeah. But if you've got a source of water, put it on a timer and see how long, you know, chances, the downside is you may water if it rains. You know, most of those weather-sensitive monitoring systems come with a more expensive irrigation system. I'm not aware of any for a home garden situation that are affordable. You might check Gardener Supply. They often have things, Drip Works. Those are just a couple that tend to have irrigation systems for home gardens. But you may just want to say, because they drain so well, I don't know, Larry.
Yeah.
If you'd agree, just set the timer, good soaking once a day.
Yeah. Yeah, that would do it.
Yeah, and then if it does get to be a rainy period, maybe you can talk to your neighbor about, can you come over and turn off the faucet if we hit a rainy period. But I think if you do a good soaking once a day, a timer, and you probably already have soaker hoses, would probably be the best way, easiest and most affordable way to go.
I have Noah and Ava, the next-door neighbor kids.
Okay.
Come over and take care of the cats and the bales.
You know, and if you have a cat, you have a better shot of getting your eye found. Somebody will feed my cats, but the plants, you know, if I'm there anyway, I'll water your plants. They won't let the cat die, so they keep the plants alive, too.
Oh, boy. Jennifer in Wauwatosa, your turn. Thanks, Jennifer, for calling.
Hi. I'm calling because I need to fix some of the grading around my house. I need to add about 6 inches of soil. In the front of the house, they have I have bushy plants, like a lilac bush. But around the side, I have more sensitive plants, like a hosta and tulip. And I'm curious how I should handle that with fixing the grading. Do I need to take them all out? And then replant them, or what advice do you have on that so I can save my plants?
Yeah, you definitely, you're going to need to take them out because burying with 6 inches of soil is going to be tough on all of them. The good news is hostas transplant easily.
Yeah.
If you can find your tulips, mine are just starting to yellow out now, so this is actually an easy time to lift them. You could always store them dry in the basement until the grading's done and then pop them back in the garden. Hostas,
okay.
I have done. Hostas, just repot them if it's going to be a while. The bushes, take as big of a root ball as you can manage. So, you know, if it's too big and you drop it, that's worse than taking a smaller root ball. I like to do for bigger plants is I'll dig a root ball, get someone to help me slide a piece of burlap underneath, carry it to the new location, or in your case, it may be wrap it up, keep it moist, cover it with wood chips to keep the roots intact until you add the soil and can replant it in the ground. And then that post-transplant care is going to be critical, especially, you know, as we're moving into the hot, dry summer.
What time for the bushes would you suggest transplanting?
Oh, if you have an option, once they go dormant, would be even better. You know, in the fall after the leaves drop or spring before growth begins would be the best time. We've all moved plants when we shouldn't, sometimes
yeah.
successful, sometimes not. Doing it now is just a little tough because we're moving into the hotter part of summer, tends to be a little drier, so the plant's root system's compromised, can't pull up as much moisture as it needs to support the top growth. But, you know, if you can wait, that would be a better option. If you can't, just do the best you can, taking as much of the root system. I wouldn't worry about the perennials and the tulips. They're tough, so they'll
yeah.
take it. But the bushes are going to be a little more challenging for you to do and for them to survive.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Good luck with that. I know you'll be busy.
Yeah. Let's go to. I'm glad I'm not the next door neighbor.
I was thinking the same thing.
Dave in Broadhead, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a question. I have a willow tree, an old, old willow tree, and a lot of the roots have become exposed. Some of them have gotten hit by the lawnmower. And I was wondering, is it safe to put topsoil over the top of that and reseed that area, or is that going to damage the tree?
You know, always the safest bet for me to say is as little of an inch of soil can kill a tree. I've seen poplars buried and survive, but you know, I always hate to take the chance with your tree giving bad advice. How would it look to mulch it? I realize, you know, cutting it with the mower is bad on your mower blades, but also hard on the tree because you're exposing those roots, opening for disease problems. And so sometimes mulching with shredded bark or wood chips is a better option. The other problem is if you did cover it with soil and your tree was fine and you planted grass, the roots tend to grow more on top than underneath, so they're going to eventually be exposed again. So it's a short-term fix that could injure the tree, but it won't solve your problem. Shade tar ground covers, I don't know if that works for you, planting in between the roots so they kind of creep over the roots, and at least you have greenery if you don't like the look of mulch. So mulching, shade-tolerant ground covers, better option for the tree. I'm just worried it's not a long-term fix to cover it with soil, and you may damage the tree.
Yep.
Okay, well, great. Appreciate it.
Okay, well, good luck with that.
Yep, thanks for calling. Herb in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Herb.
Question is there a cure or how do I treat peach leaf curl?
I don't think there is a cure. I'm going to cheat and I'm right in front of my computer. I usually don't do this.
I can't think of one.
I can't either. I don't think there is one, but I'm going to just double check with UW Extension because there's all kinds of great publications, and I know Brian, I think, has one on it, and that, yes, leaf distortions, and aren't I terrible? Peach leaf curl is unlikely to kill a peach or nectarine tree on its own, but it can cause leaf drop that then weakens it. So it says just to maintain the vigor of the tree. So,
yeah, I didn't think there was anything you could do.
Yeah, and because it survives in the bark and the bud scales, so just good cleanup. Water during drought periods, and then, you know, just making sure you take good care. If you do a fertilization in the spring, to just give it a little nutrient boost if needed. But again, avoiding high nitrogen fertilizers because you don't want to get less succulent growth. It's susceptible to other disease problems. So good plant health care. And again, as I think this was Brian or Patricia McManus, and Brian wrote that keeping it healthy, it probably won't kill the tree, but, you know, peaches struggle in our area anyway.
Yeah.
So, but the good news is once you have that first harvest, even if you only get a couple years of fresh peaches from the tree, it's worth it, right?
Yeah.
They're so delicious.
They really are. Good luck, Herb. Thank you for calling. And Cindy in Ashland, it's your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just out in my garden, and I noticed a plant is wilting, then I noticed others are wilting, and what I have is a long stem, a long skinny, skinny stem with about little leaves about every 3 or 4 inches, and the ground is all infested and just cracking like as if it were Creeping Charlie. Does that sound familiar?
What do the leaves look like?
They're just little skinny leaves, but it grows very, very tall, and it has these little skinny leaves, and it's just infesting the soil and choking the plants, literally choking them.
So it's an upright plant, but it's got lots of stems. Am I understanding this correctly?
Yes.
I'm not sure which weed it is, but what I guess I would suggest, you know, it was something you didn't plant, so... my soil's pretty dry, and I wish I would have watered yesterday before I started weeding because it's pretty hard to get the roots and all out. So what you may want to do, if it's been dry in your area, water, and then the next day it'll make it much easier to pull or dig those out. there's a lot of tall upright plants. Running bell flower comes to mind because it's got kind of not really tiny stems. Some of the goldenrods that are native but rather aggressive spread by rhizomes, and their leaves are kind of bigger, but they're upright plants as well. And they can, I think what you're saying is they're pulling up all the moisture so your good plants don't have a chance to get it, causing the soil to dry out. So I would say start removing them. If you can pull them and dig them and get as much of the rhizome out, mulch that soil. It won't kill the plant, but it'll make it easier to pull all the other annual weeds, and it will help conserve that moisture and keep after it. You can send a picture, please be patient with me, to info@melindamyers.com. And we'll take a look at it and see if we can identify it. But if it's a weed that you didn't plant, I'd say start digging.
Yeah.
And that's probably the best thing you can do to keep after it. And then if that doesn't work, then you can decide, do you need to paint on some Roundup if you're choosing to use that? The organic weed control products will burn the top off, and you can just do the same by cutting them off at ground level. So I would try pulling them out or digging them out, being careful around your good plants and start there, and then mulching the soil to conserve the moisture.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Tim and Baraboo, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
I got to planted some pine trees, some Fraser firs, and the first year, they've been there probably 3 years. This would be the third year anyway that I lost one this spring. It turned brown on me over the winter. And I got another one. I planted them in a row for a wind block. I got another one now that doesn't have any new growth on it. The one right beside it.
Yeah.
Fraser firs aren't, most of the Fraser firs we have for Christmas trees come from the south. Fraser firs aren't the best for our climate. Our summers can get a little too hot and our winters a little too cold for them. So you mentioned, so it's just the Fraser firs you're having problems, or you also put pines in as well?
No, I put in some white pines and some spruce, and they're all doing fine.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's just the fact that the Fraser firs aren't the most reliable choice for our area. Giving them a little shelter from the harsh winter winds wouldn't hurt, watching the soil moisture, avoiding those really hot parts of your landscape if possible. I think it's just the climate. Our climate's not the best. They're not the most best suited for our area. So I think it's more of a plant selection. And this winter with the cold, the warm, everybody's like, oh, it's a mild winter. And I was like, it got cold, it got hot, no snow. It was hard on our plants. And then the spring just added to that stress. So nothing you did other than trying to grow Fraser firs here in Wisconsin. It's just not an easy plant to be successful with.
Yep, that's what most of our tree people say as well. They're not a tree that does well here in Wisconsin, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately. So time to maybe look for a more suitable replacement.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, here we are, out of time, Melinda.
I know. It always goes so fast, and always a pleasure to talk to you and your listeners, Larry. Thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much, Melinda. Melinda Myers, go to her website. She's got her talk coming up on the 22nd, I believe it is. You'll get more information about that on her website, melindamyers.com, and she's got a lot of other great information as well. Well, it's been great talking with Linda, and it's great having you listening in today. And I do hope you'll stay with us, because there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.